different than our ancestors 2 centuries ago. And the connective tissue of presidential elections as this weird, it's a universal American experience, maybe the only election that's all Americans. And yet it also is experienced in different ways at different times by different people. It was surreal, so.
Well, Eric Drummond Smith, thank you for talking with me on With Good Reason.
It's been my distinct pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
Eric Drummond Smith is a political science professor at the University of Virginia College at Wise. This is With Good Reason. We'll be right back. Welcome back to With Good Reason at Virginia Humanities. In grade school, many of us learned how the founding fathers carefully defined the office of the presidency. But my next guest says the presidency was actually shaped by ordinary people, not the political elite. Nathaniel Green is a history professor at Northern Virginia Community College and the author of The Man of the People, Political Dissent and the Making of the American Presidency.
Well, it's certainly true that early presidents and early political thinkers thought a lot about the presidency. But it's also true that people outside of the presidency who would never be president also thought a great deal about the office as well. And more to the point, they argued viciously over what they thought was happening to the country or would happen to the country. It's conflict, not consensus, that really makes the presidential office. And it's conflict that really creates America, in a sense. Conflict is this defining feature of the American political landscape, not the consensus that we often imagine.
How frustrated did you find the early presidents to be with the public criticism that surrounded them?
They're all very frustrated with it. And I think that is a universal. Presidents don't like to be criticized, but it's the criticism that really drives the public discussion over the fate of the country and sort of the presidency's place within it. So yeah, none of these early presidents like this criticism. They all, in various ways, try to either ignore it, delegitimize it, try to silence it, but they can't. And so ultimately, the context that surrounds them is something they can never really control, but it exerts an immense influence over what the presidency becomes.
You write that, for example, the first president, George Washington, experienced incredible criticism when he brokered a deal with the British that came to be called the Jay Treaty. This was basically to stop the British from plundering American ships and to get them out of the Northwest Territory. Seemed like a great idea, but his opponents were furious.
So yeah, one of the things that most infuriated the critics of the Jay Treaty was that it really doesn't actually address the issue of impressment, which is this forcible enlistment of American sailors on the high seas into the British Navy. But more to the point, there were critics who argued that Washington's reaction to this criticism was severely lacking. When critics published their reservations about this treaty, some of them even took to the streets to protest this. Washington never really saw that engagement as legitimate. But what's really noteworthy about this criticism is not just that they're criticizing the Jay Treaty, but that they're making a very specific point about the relationship between the people and the presidency that needs to sort of lay the groundwork for the relationship between the people and the government at large. The reason why the American people deserve to be listened to, and critics of the Jay Treaty deserve to be listened to, they argue, is that if a president can just ignore critics, then we don't really have a republic anymore. Elected leaders have to listen to and engage with the people. That's what makes this whole thing work. And in so doing, they're really using the presidency to articulate a particular relationship between the American people and the government that they vest with power, that dissenting from the actions of government is a part of holding the government to account, to ensuring that it is always the possession of the American people. So it's a very important moment, both in the history of the presidency and in sort of this broader development of American democracy.
So Jefferson is one of the staunch opponents of the Jay Treaty and Washington for brokering this deal. And yet when he takes office, he too becomes the object of swirling criticism.
Jefferson is a Virginian. Jefferson is also the author of the Declaration of Independence, those immortal words, "All men are created equal." And early in the 1790s, Jefferson receives a letter from Benjamin Banneker, who is a black mathematician, who actually quotes the Declaration of Independence back to Jefferson and holds him to account, basically asks him in so many words, how could you have written those words and still hold black people in bondage? And the letter that Banneker writes to him includes an almanac, some of Benjamin Banneker's own work. And Jefferson writes him back. He says, "Nobody wishes more than I do to see such proofs as you exhibit that nature has given to our black brethren talents equal to those of the other colors of men, and that the appearance of a want of them is owing merely to the degraded condition of their existence both in Africa and America." Jefferson's letter is going to become public knowledge. And in the election of 1796, a opponent of Jefferson's, a Federalist from South Carolina, by the name of William Lofton Smith, is going to quote both from Jefferson's Notes on the State of Virginia, which was published previously, and then this letter that he writes to Banneker. And Smith is going to use this to argue that Jefferson really should not be president because his ideas about equality, his ideas about race are simply too dangerous.
Dangerous how?
Dangerous because it's going to essentially give black people ideas about equality and liberty, that these ideas should belong to them as well. And so these kinds of attacks on Jefferson continue even after his election in 1800. And they're not simply attacks on him, of course, they're attacks on free and enslaved black people. And they're a not so subtle way of articulating exactly what the American nation is, according to many of Jefferson's critics.
How confusing, right? Contradictory that Jefferson is both a slaveholder, but people are also criticizing him for espousing a more egalitarian point of view about the races.
It's absolutely horrific all the way around. The role of race in really shaping this conversation is emphasized really more and more as commentators on the presidency, either the critics of a sitting president or defenders of a sitting president, really try to articulate who is an American and who isn't and who poses a threat. The presidency becomes this powerful site where commentators across partisan political lines can express this kind of this aspiration for national unity, but also make it very clear what their vision of an America ultimately is. And it's a vision that includes who belongs and who doesn't, who is really an American and who is a threat. That's a common theme that really runs throughout the history of the presidency as it's debated and argued and made and remade over the course of decades.
And how does this play out with the next few presidents after Jefferson, right?
Sure. Yeah, so the United States enters the War of 1812 with Great Britain, and that is also a very divisive war. There are many in the United States who think that the war from the beginning is folly, particularly in the North. But there are Republicans who argue that it is the duty of every patriotic American to answer the call to war when the president issues it. Out of the war, Andrew Jackson emerges as a hero. And my research into Jackson really focuses on, again, the kind of commentary that swirls around Jackson in the 1820s and 30s, not only about him as a man, but also what it means for the country if he is chosen as the president. Jackson's supporters argue that Jackson is just the man that the country needs at this time. He is a man who acts dynamically, boldly, and yes, violently at times, but he does it in a way that inspires people to follow him and to follow his lead. They argue that he is just the man to unite the country, but his critics argue that he is exactly the kind of violent person. He himself is an enslaver, he is a white supremacist, he is a butcher of indigenous people, and his critics bring this up time and again to say he is indicative of exactly the kind of violence that's tearing our country apart. This becomes the way that people really talk about and argue about what America is in the 1820s and 30s and where it is possibly headed.
Do you think it is possible for any U.S. president to live up to the high-minded ideals embodied by our understanding of what the presidency should be and what the realities of the office are?
No. No, there's no way for any human being to live up to this. There's no possible way for one human being to be all things to all people. But ironically, that doesn't at all hinder the prestige of the office. In fact, that's what fuels it. That's what gives the presidency its prestige, that we argue over it. We argue over what it means to be an American. We're convinced that being an American means something, and it should mean something. We all, on some level, you know, aspire to a kind of unity. We can all kind of agree, we can all come together as one people, but that's simply never going to happen. And the conflict is really what drives the story, not the consensus. And that's true of America writ large, but it's also true of the presidency.
As you're saying that, and as you've studied the various presidencies, is there any hope of being less divisive, or is that the price of doing it the way we've chosen to do it?
Well, just because Americans have always been divided over what it means to be an American and what the presidency should be, to my mind, that doesn't mean that every vision of America is sort of either equally valid or equally invalid. I think there is a right and a wrong. We are very divided today, but I don't think that the division encompasses equally valid or equally true visions of what a good society, a democratic society, looks like. The conflict has always been a part of American history, and it has shaped what the presidency has become. I do think that we are capable of making real improvements to our society and to our world. And I do think that the presidency is capable of embodying a more democratic and a better society. But I also don't think that we need the presidency to do all of the symbolic and political work that it's done in the past. We need to have a better understanding of our past. We need to have a better understanding of our history. And that has to include the office of the presidency. And it can't just be limited to stories of the powerful. It also has to include stories of conflict that indelibly shaped who we have become and what the presidency has become. And I think that history, I hope, can inform our way forward. And maybe it's a way forward that doesn't look anything like what has been in the past, but we can't get there until we have a clearer sense of that past. And I hope that in some small way, my book contributes to that.
Nathaniel Green, this is so helpful. Thank you for talking with me on With Good Reason.
It's been a delight to be here. Thank you for having me.
Nathaniel Green is a history professor at Northern Virginia Community College. He's the author of The Man of the People, Political Dissent and the Making of the American Presidency. Coming up next, presidents, political cartoons, and the pandemic. Loaded with humor and biting satire, political cartoons have a long history of holding people in power to account. What makes them so effective? My next guest says the answer lies in the magic of visual metaphors. Fran Hassensell studies political cartoons and is a communication and theater arts professor at Old Dominion University.
Metaphors, we now know, are more than just a stylistic, you know, device, a figure of speech, but we know that they can evoke emotions. And we now know from our studies of mapping the brain and cognitive kinds of processing that they're actually a part of how we learn and how we decode and comprehend and create meaning.
Give me examples of metaphors, for instance. Just rattle off a few.
Well, most common metaphor probably, if you speak of someone as being a dog or calling someone a fox, metaphors that, you know, say that a person is a particular type of treat or food. Biden is seen now in cartoons as a kind of flim-flam man, promising great cures, but has a somewhat suspicious audience. And that was true of Trump, too. He was pictured as a flim-flam man, particularly in his advocacy of particular kinds of treatment for COVID.
You're actually now studying political cartoonists and how they're portraying COVID as an enemy.
Yes.
What are you seeing?
Well, basically, the convention of COVID as being a sphere and with little suction-type cup protrusions, and sometimes sort of stick-like arms and legs, and generally they're shown in a swarm. And of course, that makes sense because we don't generally think of an isolated germ. We think of a, you know, group or a crowd or a swarm of germs. You know, we build certain kinds of expectations, and cartoonists use these, you know, to quickly identify a character. Conventions arise on Obama's ears, other features that, you know, presidents or world leaders have. Those get a little bit exaggerated, or they become kind of what we say commonplace. All cartoonists use them.
I would think that most of the political cartoons revolving around COVID would be less the picture of the invading cell and more some scene about how COVID is being treated on the national level.
Particularly in the last administration, the cartoonists portrayed, obviously, Trump and his relationship to COVID. Even when he was in the hospital, one cartoon shows the cleaning person with, you know, the cart of equipment is in his room and is tidying up. And he's reaching for the bleach bottle that is on her cart with the idea that, my cure has arrived. But the dominant kind of image in, at least in terms of COVID, has been the image, not surprisingly, of death.
So describe a few of those cartoons.
Okay, one of the cartoons that we have Trump sitting on a little mountain of skulls. He has shrunk, and this is most visibly shown by his tie being, you know, very long, sometimes dragging on the ground. And that's, an easy enough metaphor to indicate that we're not dealing with a particularly short person here, we're dealing with a shrinking person. Anyway, the cartoon I'm referring to is basically Trump is sitting on this mountain of skulls, and he's pointing over at a bird that represents Twitter, and he's saying, look over there. And he's obviously distracting us from the image of the skulls.
Have you found any political cartoons that relate to the Biden administration dealing with the COVID pandemic?
Basically, most of the cartoons relate more to his efforts to get legislation passed in Congress. He comes and he's knocking on the door, and a little girl greets him at the door. She's there with her dog. And he's wearing a poster board, sign board that says, Dr. Flim Flam's Magic Elixir Fixer. And then it says, $1 trillion bill, free. And he's holding up a bottle, and the bottle has fumes coming from it. And the little girl's response is, "Sorry, but my dad says that something that seems to be too good to be true probably isn't." So basically, I've seen more cartoons dealing with Biden's efforts to get bills passed, fix the economy. He does have an image of death. He's shown with a defibrillator trying to reconnect, restart his Build Back Better campaign. And the nurse is saying to him, "Mr. President, he's been dead for a couple of weeks."
We've gone from about 1,000 working political cartoonists 100 years ago to really no more than 30 full-time paid newspaper-based jobs for editorial cartoonists. Where did they go?
Most of them have gone freelance. In other words, they're no longer on the employ of a given newspaper. They're basically selling to whomever will purchase. And these cartoons often are also spread on the internet. It's not difficult to capture the image and to tweet it or to put it in Facebook or wherever. And of course, policing and enforcing this is a tremendous task and not a high priority on the part of the various vendors. So the cartoons get disseminated far beyond the newspaper. There's probably about 350 active cartoonists. And yes, it is not a growth business.
What do you think we're losing, though, as we've lost so many full-time paid editorial cartoonists?
The political cartoon has a kind of a two-pronged approach. It certainly touches on our emotions and on our feelings. But we now know from cognitive psychology that it taps into our epistemology, our way we learn. We don't necessarily get up in the morning and start thinking about some of these events that are happening, you know, because in the morning we're usually running late, and so we're rushed a little bit, and there's, you know, getting organized and whatever. But the cartoon basically intrudes on our thinking and on our feelings, and in effect kind of jabs us so that, oh yeah, things are not going well in Congress. Oh yeah, there's a dangerous situation out there. So basically it pulls on our attention, it pulls us in and focuses us on a particular concern or a particular event. And with that attention, we may have it accompanied with some feelings or emotional responses. We might say, oh, that's really clever, or gee, that's too bad, or whatever our, you know, our response is going to be.
So true, so true. Well, Fran Hassenzell, thank you for talking with me on With Good Reason.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here, and I love talking about cartoons, and they may be diminished, but they're still out there, and beware, Tammany Hall, Thomas Nast did bring you down. Every little chink in the armor can change things.
As Mark Twain said, against the assault of laughter, nothing can stand.
That's right.
Fran Hassenzell is a communication and theater arts professor at Old Dominion University. Support for With Good Reason is provided by the University of Virginia Health System, pioneering treatments to save lives and preserve brain function for stroke patients, uvahealth.com. With Good Reason is produced by Virginia Humanities, which acknowledges the Monacan Nation, the original people of the land and waters of our home in Charlottesville, Virginia, Our production team is Allison Quantz, Matt Darrow, Lauren Francis, and Jamal Milner. Maya Neer and Cassandra Deering are our interns. Special thanks this week to Todd Washburn at WHRO. For the podcast, go to withgoodreasonradio.org. I'm Sarah McConnell. Thanks for listening. Thank you.
funny. Daddy! Saw that thing so beautiful. Daddy! She just hit my heart, oh. Daddy! Full force and she got me like. Daddy! I be like. Daddy! Baby. Daddy! Why you so fine?
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 10 a.m. Next up is American Standoff with Jacqueline Keeler.
Your head up, lift the top of your mind, put your